Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil,
ojo ahora el error de Tim Krul, le ha robado el balón a Aubameyang. Gol del Arsenal. Qué error de Tim Krul, qué fallo del portero del Norwich.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra. Well, an extra Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good morning to you.
Good morning to you too. How you doing?
I am all right. I've got a coffee. I've collected my thoughts on what I saw last night. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to get into this. I'm ready to take umbrage at certain things, be happy about certain things. I am glad we didn't get to see too much of Brendan Rodgers' teeth. So, you know, I think I feel okay this morning. How about you?
He is the most extraordinary looking creature these days, isn't he?
Creature.
He honestly looks like he's sort of been, I don't know, hewn from bark or something. His skin's all weird and his teeth don't fit his face anymore. I think he's gone too far. It's kind of like a moralistic tale, isn't it, about the dangers of vanity?
Yeah, you know that woman that they always hold up as the person who, you know, had too much plastic surgery, and she ended up looking like one of the Thundercats.
Yeah, she did, very much so, yeah.
He's going that direction. But look, we won't dwell too much on Brendan Rodgers. We'll talk about Arsenal. We'll talk about Arsenal 1, Leicester 1 at the Emirates last night, a game in which, in the end, I was quite relieved to come away with a point from, but that relief was immediately tinged by frustration because I felt very strongly that this is a game that we should have won. I think that was an opinion also held by Mikel Arteta, considering the chances that we had in the first half, etc., etc., the circumstances, the red card for Eddie Nketiah will come to in the end. But overall, your feeling on the night, I mean, when you are down to 10 men and there's 8 minutes of injury time, your mind goes to the dark place. It goes to the dark place. And when the dark thing doesn't happen, you're sort of like, whew, okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, from that point of view, that's, I think, where there's an element of relief.
I think so. I mean, I saw a few people after the game saying, I probably would have taken a draw beforehand, but I don't know if I would have done, given the respective momentum of the two teams. Leicester haven't been the force they were before the lockdown, and Arsenal have been in really good form. So I fancied us in this match.
What did we predict? Can you remember?
I don't remember. I think you predicted a draw, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
Let's have a look. I think I've got it here. Boom, boom, boom. Leicester, I predicted a win, and you predicted a win.
Right. So there we go. So I would not have taken a draw. I felt this was a game, even way back when I made those predictions, that we would win. But like you, when we went down to 10 men, and actually before we went down to 10 men, I mean, the whole second half, we were not so good. The sending off definitely kind of sealed our fate in some respects. But I was having kind of premonitions that a bad thing might well cometh. But fortunately, it didn't.
Tell me this. Did you have any issues with the starting lineup? Any surprises in terms of the team that Mikel Arteta picked? The only one I can really think of is Saka from the right-hand side, which slightly raised my eyebrow based on how he struggled a little bit out there in the previous game. But maybe it was a big learning curve for him because he was an awful lot better last night.
Well, you told me that Nicola Pepe hadn't given birth himself, and therefore he would be available to play. But maybe he was more involved than we imagined.
Maybe I was
wrong.
Maybe I'll hold my hands up there. Maybe
he was the surrogate.
Maybe I got that one all wrong. So yeah.
I was. Listen, I certainly, after everything we've been through in the last few months, people prioritising family first and things like that, I've got no issue with it. But I was still a little bit disappointed on one side of me to not see him play. I was looking forward to it. I was also surprised by Saka, although, as we'll come on to, I think the decision was justified to play him in that position. Just trying to think. Everything else was pretty much as expected. I was maybe not sure certain that Bellerin would come back in, but of course it makes perfect sense that he did, and I thought he had a better game too. So no real surprises in the lineups, and Leicester had a back three as well that they switched to recently.
That was slightly a surprise, wasn't it?
A little bit. I mean, it made it an interesting game because it was sort of, it was quite light in the middle of the park, and in some ways that suited us because it enabled us to kind of tack down the flanks quite effectively.
Yeah, and I think it suited Danny Ceballos, who we'll come on to now in a moment. It's worth pointing out that for all the chances and what have you that we had in the first half, there were a couple of moments early on from Leicester which were dangerous, little warning signs, if you like, and one in particular stood out to me was the fact that we got done again on a short corner. I think it was Saka who was left 2-on-1. I can't see from the footage who exactly should have been out there, but you know, I don't know that, you know, we stepped up. I think Lacazette tried to play offside rather than go out to the to cover the gap and to cover the space and everything else, but that will have been a little bit of a worry for Mikel Arteta when you consider what happened against Brighton.
Yeah, definitely, and it felt like Leicester almost had looked at that and thought, I will have a crack at that, and the fact they were able to do it will have, I'm sure, irritated Arteta, because he must have looked at that detail after the Brighton game and looked at it. And there were a couple of other moments at our end. I mean, Ian Acho put one in, didn't he, when he was offside from a Vardy.
It wasn't offside, it was a foul on Kolasinac.
It was a foul, yeah. And actually, I was glad that the referee saw that. It was one of those that gets missed sometimes, you know, where it sort of happens off the ball, but I'm trying to think of others. But, I mean, really, the story of the first half was Arsenal playing as well as they have for quite some time, I thought, going forward, certainly.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think there was a lot of positives in that first half from an Arsenal point of view in terms of how we played, how we moved the ball, how we used the spaces, how we looked to get behind that Leicester, back three. Soyuncu was a little bit sluggish, I think, at times, and he had Bellerin, he had Saka to deal with, and struggled a little bit at times, and there was a confidence about the way that we were playing when we got forward as well. There was that lovely moment when was it a 1-2 with Bellerin, Saka, and Bellerin played a 1-2, and Bellerin, you know, nutmegged the guy to feed Saka in through that inside channel. The cross ended up being blocked and what have you. But, you know, from an attacking point of view, the intent that we showed on both flanks, I think, was really, really exciting, and it did lead to some chances.
It did, yeah. And great to see Bellerin getting forward and combining in the final third. Saka was brilliant, but, you know, I can't wait to see him doing that with Pepe. I think that could be really exciting. And, you know, you're right. I mean, their centre-halves didn't look massively comfortable in the channels, between the sort of outside centre-half and the wing-back, and we exploited that with Tierney going up the other flank as well. You know, he had a pretty high starting position, was involved a lot going forward. So, yeah, I liked it. I liked the shape. And we mentioned the midfield situation suiting Ceballos. I mean, I think his first half was up there with anything he's produced, even, you know, the sort of iconic Burnley performance that we look back on now.
Yes, I agree. And it's quite noticeable now that Mikel Arteta is talking a lot less to him during the games than he had been previously. So we talk about, you know, Saka learning from the right, against Wolves. Maybe Ceballos is getting to understand what Arteta wants from him in that position. I think he said after the game that defensively, Ceballos has taken a real step forward, which, you know, I think is part of the fundamentals of what Arteta wants from his players, isn't it? Is that awareness, the duty that you have when we don't have the ball is a big part of what he's trying to instill in this team. But what I really liked about Ceballos was some of the adventure that he showed in his play. He'd take the ball in tight areas. There were a couple of really nice turns. There were some good passes, and obviously that pass through to Saka for the Aubameyang goal was absolutely superb. I don't think you can give enough praise for the pass. I mean, we have to give some credit, of course, a lot of credit to Bukayo Saka for making the run, but Ceballos was able to see it, had the vision and had the execution to play the ball down that inside channel, and it led to Aubameyang's goal.
Yeah, it was a great pass. I mean, and this is not to compare Ceballos with this player, but it was a Fabregas-style pass. I remember him making that pass several times, you know, in his days at Arsenal. And it's funny with Ceballos. I think, you know, with certain signings like Nicola Pepe, I think we're prepared to say he needs time to adapt. He's coming from a foreign country. In a weird way, because Ceballos was signed on a 12-month loan, he doesn't get that time. He kind of, there's an expectation that he has to hit the ground running, despite the fact that he's a relatively young guy coming from La Liga, coming from a really different style of football. Maybe it's only natural that it should take him a period to acclimatise and adjust to the demands of a new league. The problem is, of course, he's making that adjustment now in July. Technically, his loan should be over.
Yeah.
So it sort of raises an interesting question, doesn't it, about where you go from here?
Sure. It's a very, yeah, that's a very interesting point. And I think we've got a question about Ceballos in part two, so we'll save the wider discussion for that. But it's also worth remembering that Ceballos suffered a fairly significant injury. He was out for 2.5 months. And I think what's really pleasing about what we're seeing from Ceballos now is that we looked at him and we thought, okay, this guy isn't really what we were expecting, but Arteta challenged him and challenged him publicly, didn't he, to sort of get on board with what he was doing, with what he wanted to do. And you know, there was talk about him leaving in January, and it was fairly serious talk. And that was something that was given consideration to by all parties, the player, by Arsenal, by Real Madrid, and by some suitors as well. But he decided to stay, he decided to stick it out. I think Arteta said he trained like an animal were the words that he used. And you have to really give some credit to a player who's willing to apply himself in that way to a club where he doesn't know if he's going to be here next season or not, whether, you know, whether he's playing for another loan move at Arsenal, another season at Arsenal, we don't know. But that commitment to what Arteta is trying to do and to the team, I think, is really, really positive, particularly when there are players right now who are deliberately excluding themselves from selection by their own behaviour. I think what Ceballos is showing in the last few weeks is very commendable.
That's a really good point. And for a player who's on loan, as you say, doesn't know where his future lies, could very easily be sort of mentally checking out at this stage of his contract with the club. You know, since the January transfer window closed, his focus has been pretty clear and his determination has been really clear. And, you know, given that he's not contractually committed to the cause, I think you can see he is committed to the cause and he loves his football. He loves being out there. He celebrates every goal like a madman, whether he's involved or not. And yeah, I'm really enjoying watching him and seeing this little partnership with Xhaka develop. And Arteta gave it a shout out after the game. On the goal, brilliant ball from Ceballos and really excellent play from Saka, isn't it? On that right-hand side where you sort of wonder, is he going to be able to go outside there onto his right foot? And he just stops, leaves Johnny Evans. I mean, probably still lying there on the ground, presumably. And a perfect pass for Aubameyang. It's funny, we scored those brilliant team goals against Leicester last season where there were a couple of balls across the goal for Aubameyang to score. And this was, you know, almost of that calibre, I thought.
Yeah, it was a great goal. I think it was a really nice move, and it really seemed to invigorate the team. Aubameyang got down the left. I think he tried to cross for Saka, and it was Soyuncu who cleared over the bar.
Yeah,
Saka created a good chance for Lacazette. It was an interesting little move that I think had he gone over in the tackle in the box, I think we would have had a penalty, but he stayed on his feet, created a chance. Lacazette, you know,
strong shot,
but a good save from Schmeichel. Schmeichel save from Bellerin, Saka with a chance created by Lacazette. And then
the save from Bellerin is great, by the way, as well, I think. I mean, I think if, I don't know what Hector knew about that. I don't know if he... Do you think that was deliberate from him?
I have a slight feeling it was a mishit cross rather than an attempt on goal. I think if he'd been trying to score, he might have gone low at the near post.
If he goes low, he scores,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly. I'm not quite sure. Maybe it was one of those that he was sort of caught in two minds.
I think it was that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He saw it at the last minute, I think.
Yeah. It was a little bit unlucky because, you know, had the goalkeeper taken another step or half a step, I'm not sure he would have got there. But, you know, it was good pressure from Arsenal and it was good play. And Bellerin, of course, created what I think was the best chance of them all. which was for Lacazette. He took the ball infield. It was a beautiful cross over the top of the defense, floated perfectly for Lacazette. And I really think that's a bad miss. I think it's a bad miss for a player
Alan
of his
Smith
experience.
Knew it on commentary too. He said straight away, "Oh, big chance." I think that cross, by the way, is about the best thing I've seen from Hector Bellerin this season. I mean, it was a really outstanding pass. And I couldn't really believe my eyes because Lacazette has had such a similar chance from a Ceballos pass, didn't he, in the last home game?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
That one went straight at the keeper. This time he kind of went far top corner, but he had to head it down, didn't he?
Of course. It's what you're taught as a kid when you're in that sort of position, head the ball down because the goalkeeper, you know, he can't get down quickly enough. It was quite close to goal as well. And I think when you just head it straight at head height, it's very easy for a goalkeeper of Premier League quality.
Does.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it is a bad miss, and I was looking at that thinking, uh-oh, I hope we don't learn or live to regret that. You know,
there was another chance where Saka on his right foot.
That's the one that Lacazette set up for him, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Arteta said afterwards, we've got to bury them, we've got to put these chances away.
Kill them is what he said. Yeah.
Kill them before you bury them, of course, the traditional fashion. I do think that the Lacazette header is the only one where I was like, you've got to score. Do you know what I mean? I thought there were other situations where we were in dangerous positions, but that was the one that I looked at and was like, we will regret that one.
Yeah, no, I think that was the best of the chances. I do think that the Saka one as well was, you know, if that had fallen on his left foot rather than his right foot, I think the position that he was in, you would want him to do better there. And it's not to be critical of Saka. It seems churlish to be critical of an 18-year-old who's playing so well and made such a big contribution in the game, but it was a very good chance. But the Lacazette was the one, that was one where I just thought, oh, fuck. You know, if you go in 2-0, you've got that nice cushion. And as it turned out, I think we did live to regret that missed chance. And it's not to, you know, slaughter Lacazette or anything like it. But I just feel, you know, an experienced striker has got to score from there. They've just got to score or at least make the goalkeeper make a save, you know, rather than make it easy for him.
And, I mean, it's tricky for Lacazette because in some ways I thought he had a much better all-round game than he has done recently.
Can I ask you a question about him, though?
Yeah.
How do you think he's moving? Because he looks to me like a guy who isn't, I don't know, whether he's just got heavy legs or he's not quite fit. It just seems like everything takes him a half a touch or a touch longer than it should.
Look, if it came out at the end of the season, Lacazette's off to have some procedure done, you wouldn't be at all surprised, would you? Because I do think the speed of his seeming decline is very dramatic. You know, I think it's been forgotten that last season, even if his goals tally wasn't what we hoped necessarily, he was a pretty effective player in a lot of situations. I mean, he was literally voted player of the season.
And the goals that he scored, not all the goals, but a lot of the goals that he scored last season were based on quick movement in the box, a quick turn in the box, a quick shot. Yeah. And we haven't seen anything like that from him this season.
Yeah, and I think people do often underestimate with strikers how important confidence is. Like, it can be absolutely massive to a player. But, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if there were some physical issues too. And, of course, physical decline happens, and maybe that's part of it. But, it is a very dramatic change, and that just makes me wonder what's going on there. Maybe we'll never know, but it's an interesting question. I agree with you. He's not moving as sharply as he was. I'm not talking about speed over the ground. That's never been his strength necessarily, but it's the fluidity of moment and the ability to turn sharply that has gone.
So we're into the second half, and, you know, we had a chance. I think David Luiz had a free kick which didn't go in, which I think is pretty much what you expect from a David Luiz free kick, unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, there is the law of averages that, you know, sooner or later he's got to get one in, but I don't feel particularly confident when he's standing over the ball. I can't remember who it was. Was it Redknapp or somebody last week? Who was it? I can't remember. He took a free kick and they were talking about the technique. And they said, you know, he makes it look like he sort of looks like he side foots it. And I was looking at it going, yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. That's exactly what he's not some fucking magic trick guy.
Yeah, it feels like whatever David Luiz is trying to do from free kicks at the moment isn't really happening. Like if he's trying to do that sort of slightly punty, wobbly shot, it's not coming off. I mean, he's basically just side footing them straight at the keeper at the moment, wide or over. I'm not filled with loads of confidence, but I will be. Hopefully the fans are back in the stadium by the time he scores one. I'd say the chances are they will be.
He'd probably be retired by the
in
time
in 2025.
Leicester, I think, were better in the second half. They had a lot more of the ball, and I don't know if it was because of the game state, if you like, that we're 1-0 up and we don't have to go chasing per se. I just wondered if in that circumstance we might have been a little bit braver in terms of what we did with our changes. It took a while for Mikel Arteta to make any changes. It was 75 minutes, I think, before he made the first one. And given the fact that we were sitting and soaking up pressure from Leicester, maybe that's not exactly what we wanted to do, but that's what was happening. I wonder if putting Pepe on for Lacazette, moving Aubameyang central, Saka to the left, might have been a braver way to approach that second half. I mean, we've talked about Arteta's substitutions in the last couple of games, and we've said they've been very good, they've been very effective, they've helped win us the games, and all the credit is due there. I just wonder if this time he was found a little bit wanting. I wonder as well if, you know, this is our second game in 3 days, and he's thinking half an eye anyway on the North London Derby on Sunday and getting players, getting some rest into their legs. It just felt like we didn't quite address the momentum that Leicester had.
Maybe, yeah. I mean,
and it's hard to judge. It is hard to judge how effective the substitutions might have been, because obviously Nketiah got sent off within a couple of minutes.
That's it. And Pepe is, you know, the one who you'd look at and say, would he have been a good sub? I mean, as far as I'm aware, he didn't train before the game, which may have played into Arteta's decision-making as well. And Willock's been really good sort of coming on in that kind of counter-attacking role.
Yeah.
I thought they came a bit late, the changes. That was my main thing. I know Joe Willock was sort of stripped and ready to come on about 4 minutes before that. But Leicester were on top the entirety of the second half, really. And I was quite surprised by some of the changes they made. They took Iheanacho off, for example, who was looking relatively dangerous. I have a bit of sympathy with Arteta, because the changes that he made were obviously completely undone straight away by the sending off.
Okay, what's your thought on the sending off? Is it a red card? Is it not a red card? Is it harsh? Is it, you know, red by the letter of the law? What's your thinking on it?
My thinking is it's unlucky for Nketiah, but it is a red card.
Right.
What do you think?
I thought it was unlucky too. Maybe a little bit harsh, but you know what we saw was them playing replay after replay after replay of Studs hitting the opponent's knee, the outside of his knee, and it was split second stuff. But it sort of reminded me a little bit of the Aubameyang red card. Was it against Crystal Palace, where you know he was going for the ball, he missed it by split second, and his foot lands on the ankle of, I think it was Max Meyer, was it? And you have that horrific image, which makes it look like a worse challenge than it actually was. And I think the replays made it clear that they were going to send him off, you know? And it's the thing that I look at, you know, when I look at red cards that happen to us, I think, would I be screaming for a red card if that challenge went in on one of the Arsenal players. And it was sort of in that ballpark for me.
I'm sure you would. I'm sure you would. Having done, I've done this podcast long enough to be sure that you would be. I mean, I have to say, in real time, I thought it was a bad challenge as well. Mm. Like, it's a little bit unfortunate because it's partly the way the guy turns into the challenge. Do you know what I mean? That it's sort of, it's a coming together of the knee and the foot, but... And I really do feel for Nketiah because you know what Arteta's instructions to him will have been. You know, get out there. I think he said after the game last week, I like to make a nuisance of myself. He's always closing down, chasing into challenges. And three games he could miss now. I mean, that's a heavy punishment, isn't it, at this stage of the season?
It is. I mean, there is the possibility of an appeal because I think it's a yellow card that became a red card. So we'll wait and see what they do. This leads us on to the Jamie Vardy incident at the end of the first half. And Mikel Arteta seemed quite angry. I'm sure he was angry at conceding a late goal and everything else, but basically was saying, look, if Nketiah has a red card, then so is Vardy. And I have to say, I looked at it in real time when it happened and I thought, oh, well, that's just a bit of an accident. It's one of those where a player, you know, two players are competing, they fall awkwardly, it's a wet night, he slips, whatever it might be, it was purely accidental. And then I watched the replays and I'm pretty sure I'm wrong. In the sense that, like, I can't be 100% sure that he meant to do it. But I am 100% sure that it was not 100% accidental.
Yeah, I have watched it as well. I don't really know, given the direction he's falling, like, his legs are going to move. Do you know what I mean? It's like he's sort of almost rolling. But he does have a look.
And then kind of throws the leg out.
Yeah,
It is
the same, though.
It is Jamie Vardy as well. I mean, should we be giving him any benefit of the doubt?
Yeah, he tried to kill him. He tried to murder a man in cold blood.
No, but you know what I mean? It's not like there isn't a little bit of you know, he's a sly fucker. He is he's a very experienced player. He knows what he can get away with and what he can't get away with for the most part. You know, we can't say conclusively that he meant to do what he did, but I think... my gut feeling tells me that he threw his leg out deliberately there.
Well, the thing is, I'm not sure, but I do think that Eddie Nketiah didn't mean to hurt the guy he went to. Didn't mean to catch the guy, even. And therefore, if his challenge is dangerous and thus a red card, sort of by the extension of that logic... I think Vardy's maybe is too.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes down to whether or not it's reckless, I suppose. But yeah, I think it's a really good point Arteta makes. When he made it, I was like, I wasn't sure what he was talking about. I'd completely forgotten what happened in the first half. There's some good pictures from David Price today of Mustafi with a couple of bullet wounds in his head, essentially, from the studs. And I mean, if VAR is going to interfere on things like the Nketiah thing, I think it should do... on things like Mustafi thing. More than anything, I'm pleased to see Arteta sort of go into bat for Arsenal in that situation.
Yeah,
you know, that's his job.
We had a question, actually, and I'll do it now, seeing as we're talking about it. It comes from Highbury Days, who's at Highbury Days _ on Twitter. He says, what do you think about Arteta's comments on the referee and VAR? I think he did the right thing by putting pressure on them. Arsenal have been taken for a small club for years now, and it's about time Arteta started being a bit of a prick towards them. Which, you know, I get what he's... I get what he's saying there, you know. I'm not saying that Arteta is a prick, but certainly, you know, I'm looking at the FA website here, right? And it's the FA Fair Play table, and Liverpool are top of the FA Fair Play table, and Arsenal are bottom by a long, long way. We have 358 disciplinary points, and Bournemouth, who are 19th in that table, have 314. Liverpool are top of the table, 166, by the way. So, you know, this is, it's quite funny because I don't think we are a dirty team in any way, but we have more bookings than any other team in the Premier League this season. We have the same amount of sendings off as Watford, Man City, Southampton. Arteta is aware that this is a bit of an issue because he said, look, this is the fourth time that we've gone down to 10 men since I took over. We have to improve that. But I do wonder if there is an element of Arsenal being seen as kind of a soft touch, an easy team or an easy club to give decisions against, you know?
I think that's true. Yeah. I do think that's true. I think a lot of the bookings, I mentioned this the other week, are down to our sort of newfound love of the tactical foul. And I have to say, Alex Lacazette's tactical foul in the first half was one of the best things I've seen from him in a while. I don't know if you remember it.
I do, but can I just cut across here? There were tactical fouls committed by Leicester City as well. There was one, I think it was Evans, went through the back of Lacazette, who sort of stood on his ankle. And the guy was playing right centre half for Leicester, was it Bennett, I think, a couple of times completely blocked off. There was one in particular with Tierney where he just literally obstructed him, a perfectly cromulent, cynical tactical foul, all well and good. I mean, I see how those things are useful for teams, but why are they yellow cards when we do it and it's not a yellow card when that guy does it? That's the sort of stuff that gets fans a little bit irate. You know, if there's consistency in the decision-making there, I mean, by the letter of the law, that foul on Tierney should have been a yellow card. Leicester get away with it. Arsenal, when we make those fouls, do not get away with it. And this is where I think Highbury Days has a really good point, that unless we start addressing that particular issue, referees will just continue to give those yellow cards and give those red cards. Whereas if they've got a little bit of doubt in their mind, or if they feel like they might get challenged a little bit, maybe it has an impact on their decision making.
Yeah, I think, you know, a manager putting pressure on referees, I mean, Sir Alex Ferguson did it so successfully, didn't he, for Manchester United? I mean, he created a huge advantage by doing that. But I think that there is a perception around Arsenal that maybe makes it easier for referees to give decisions against them or not give decisions in their favour. For example, the perception that Arsenal are soft, right? So if a player goes to ground under a challenge, it's like, oh, well, that's an Arsenal player around on the floor. And, you know, we have to change that. And the best way to change it is through our performances and what we do with the team. But if Arteta's going to speak out and play his part, I am absolutely all for that. I think, you know, it's part of the job description. If you're going to be a top Premier League manager, controlling the referees is part of it. It's absolutely part of it.
And it's not like blaming the officials for what we do on the pitch or saying, you know, making excuses, because some people will say, well, that's just making excuses. You're deflecting, you're doing this, you know, you're taking away from the issues that you have. That's not why you didn't win the game, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, you know, that's fair enough. But I do think it is part, I think I'm with you, it is part of what a manager needs to do in the modern game is be strong and stand up for his team and to try in as many ways as he possibly can to influence things in a positive way for his team when they take to the pitch. And this is
everyone else is going to do it.
Exactly.
Everyone else is going to do it. So we've got to play that game too.
Yeah, for sure. And I think this is not to be critical of Unai Emery or anything like it, but this is where communication and the ability to speak a language properly has a big part. Because if Emery had come out with something like that, people would be saying, listen to this cunt. You know what I mean? This is him sort of half-arse going around this particular issue, whereas, you know, Arteta can be very clear about it. I think he was very clear about it last night, and I'm happy for it.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, Emery was also always a bit reluctant to do it. And in some ways, I had a bit of admiration for that because, you know, he never really put it on the officials. But, like we say, it's part of the job description, I think. And Arteta can be so cold and to the point when he wants to be, and I thought he was great in his post-match interview.
Yeah, I was watching the post-match interview and I was a bit like, ooh, Mufasa. A little bit. You know, there was a little bit of like, ooh, he's got some steel to him when his dander is up, you know? So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed seeing that, and I enjoyed the fact that he didn't hide, you know, his unhappiness with what his team did on the pitch as well. You know, he can be pissed off about the red card, and the red card incidents, but he was also very clear that it was up to his team to take their chances and score the goals that they should have scored in that first half. Let's very briefly just touch on their equaliser before we go into part two and take some questions. It felt like a tired goal to concede. We were sitting quite deep, and when you look back on it, I think there are a number of players who could just do a tiny bit better. I don't think there was any glaring mistake from any one individual, but when you look at it, I think Xhaka was maybe beaten a bit too easily. Kolasinac sort of turned his back on the cross. Mustafi, who has been very good, and I'm not being critical of him here, is maybe just a little bit sharper to read the game. The ball traveled a long way through our box to get to Vardy. So it just felt maybe like the physical effects of the last number of weeks played a part in that goal, and of course being down to 10 men.
Yeah, and in fairness to Mustafi, I mean, no one's played more minutes than him, and Vardy is so sharp in that part of the pitch. It's a really good cross as well that's into a very dangerous area. But, I mean, it was coming, wasn't it? And so it was one of those you were like, ah, there it is. You know, Emi Martinez is beatable, despite a very good performance again. And, I mean, all the VAR nonsense that followed. I mean, listen, everyone knows, I think, what I think about VAR. I think it's bollocks and I would get rid of it. But I think on a technical level, I mean, what did you think? Do you think that's offside?
No.
No.
I don't think so. I mean, there was nothing conclusive where you could say, yes, absolutely, he's offside, his foot is offside. Like, there was nothing there that made me think we'd been particularly hard done by. I don't really know why it took as long as it did. I think they were looking for the...
If he touches the ball at the near post, the other dude, Perez, isn't it?
Yeah.
Then it creates a new phase and Vardy becomes offside. But, I mean, how can you say if he touched it or not? It's impossible, really.
I mean, I think you can say he touched it if it's clear that he touched it. It's absolutely not clear whether he touched it or not. I don't think he did. I watched the replays as much as anyone else, and I can't.
We all watched it many, many times.
Many times, hoping and praying, of course, that VAR would come down on our side. But, you know, it didn't. And I think you're right. The goal had been coming. And that's why I went into those final 10 minutes or so with injury time with such trepidation. Because, you know, when you concede like that, when you're on the back foot, when you're defending, when you're trying to... when you're trying to hold out against 11 men, and Leicester are a good side, as we've seen this season, and they are where they are in the table for, you know, it's not a fluke that they are where they are. That's why there was such trepidation and ultimately why there was relief at the final whistle.
Yeah, there was. And, you know, we did okay in those final few minutes. We did what we needed to do. And it's a strange sort of result in a way, because you were felt relieved, but simultaneously quite frustrated.
Mm. Yeah, and just before we go into part two, I think the main takeaway that I would have from this game is, or the main positive certainly that I would take from this game, is the fact that we created those chances in the first half, is the fact that we were able to play the way that we played in the first half, that we can come away, you know, from that first 45 minutes with regret. Because some of the football that we played was really, really nice. Again, you know, against a good team, to be able to create those chances. We were profligate. Unfortunately, it came back to bite us. But I think as we're building, as we're rebuilding, as we're looking for positives, things to build on, that first 45 minutes was definitely something we can be really happy with.
Yeah, and I also think we might just be starting to run out of legs, potentially. You know, I in that second half, I sort of looked at us and thought, I don't know if we've got another gear here. And maybe it would have been different had we had the subs, you know, worked out like planned and we'd not gone down to 10 men. But with 10 men, we were sort of physically stretched. And, yeah, look, I mean, we come away with the draw. And what does it change for us, really? I mean, we're now, I suppose hopes of sort of fifth place are significantly slimmer, aren't they?
They are. When you look at the table, I think we would have been, what, 3 points behind Manchester United or 2 points behind Manchester United? What would it have been?
Three.
And look, you know, they have a game in hand anyway. We've only got 4 games left, and there's a North London derby. There's a game against Liverpool as well. So, you know, I think... yeah, it's a little bit frustrating to drop those 2 points. But in the circumstances and the context of the game, you have to sort of reshape your thinking. So look, okay, let's leave it there for that. We are going to take a small break. We will be back with your questions in part two right after this.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog on the Arsblog Facebook page, facebook.com/TheArsblog, and also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. And ahead of the North London Derby on Sunday, James, I've got some very, very disheartening news, unfortunately, to kick off part two of the show. Eric Dier has been suspended for 4 games with immediate effect and fined £40,000 and warned as to his future conduct for climbing into the crowd and having a pop at some spectators. So that's bad news from an Arsenal point of view.
Are you sure we can't appeal?
Yeah.
Can we appeal that he's still available for Sunday?
Yeah. Oh, well. Anyway, let's take a question on the North London Derby, because with Eddie Nketiah suspended, Zach Taze on the Discord wants to know, what would your front three for the North London Derby be? I'd personally love to see Aubameyang down the middle, Saka on the left, and Pepe on the right.
I think that's what I would go with as well. I think. I mean, Arteta's so wedded to the idea of either Lacazette or Nketiah at centre-forward that I do have a hunch that that's what it will be, and it will be Saka as a left wing-back, maybe, with Aubameyang to the left, Pepe to the right. But if you're asking just my opinion, I think I would go Saka, Aubameyang, Pepe, yeah. Mm. What about you?
I'd be really tempted by that. Really, really tempted by that. You know, I think Aubameyang down the middle, he was asked about it afterwards, wasn't he? Arteta, I can't remember exactly what he said. He didn't really get into it. Didn't really. He said it's something they'll think about and what have you. But what did he say? Boom, 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 boom. Playing Aubameyang through the centre. I'll look at the options that we have up front now and see how we can be a little bit diverse and have different options. But obviously we wait and see if the suspension for Eddie, how long it is, and we will adapt.
Because I think if Nketiah is available, he would start on Sunday.
I think that was the plan, yeah, to play Lacazette tonight in a home game, or last night in a home game, and then use Nketiah and use his fresher, quicker legs in the derby.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it comes at a really tricky time. I mean, I think they're going to have to play Aubameyang through the middle at some point in the next week and a half or whatever it is, because I just don't think Lacazette can play the Spurs game, the Liverpool game and the Man City game. I don't think he looks like he's got it in him.
No, I mean, Arteta wants a lot of work, doesn't he, from the player in that position. He wants a lot of running, a lot of pressing, a lot of chasing and harrying. And it doesn't, yeah, I agree with you. I don't think Lacazette is really capable of playing that many games. So the only other option we have is Aubameyang. We do have other options in the wide positions. So we can play Saka on the left and put Aubameyang through the middle. We can play Pepe on the right, you know. So I don't see them like dipping down into the academy.
The kids. Well, no. Balogun's leaving anyway. He'd be the obvious one.
Mm.
And I don't necessarily see them giving him game time, given what's gone on there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, what are your other options through the middle? I mean, Pepe through the middle is an option, potentially.
It'd just be a bit of a kick in Aubameyang's teeth, wouldn't it? That, like, if you're playing... If you're playing Pepe through the middle and you're not giving this, I guess, world-class centre-forward a game at centre-forward, which is where he wants to play. I mean, he's doing a job for the team, and Arteta was very clear about, you know, what a team player he is and how willing he is to work and everything else. And there's some method to the madness, if you want to call it that, in terms of playing him on the left-hand side. But if there's a big gap there and then you choose somebody else, I'm not sure how well that would go down.
I think it has to be that front three, thinking about it. Because away from home, we know Lacazette has his problems anyway. If you can use Lacazette in the home game against Liverpool in a week's time when he's had a bit more rest. And I think, you know, you can go with Aubameyang and Pepe either side maybe in that one.
Mm.
But Spurs away, yeah, let's go Saka left, Pepe right, Aubameyang through the middle. I mean, that gives you three potential goal scorers in your team as well, which is something we desperately need at the moment. Yeah, that would be my choice for sure.
Mm, okay.
And it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I don't think Arteta would ever have done it by choice, really. I don't think it's what he thinks is the right setup for the team, but I think it slightly forces his hand at the moment.
What do you think the problem might be there? Because we saw Aubameyang take some central positions yesterday, and there was one, was it... I don't know if it was a goal kick by Martinez or if it was a long ball from David Luiz straight down the middle and Aubameyang chased it down. I think it could have been the one where he backheeled it to Saka. Saka got a bit of luck and got into the box. I think that could have been one of the chances for Lacazette. Mm. We've seen Aubameyang close down the goalkeeper to great effect in the Norwich game where he got a goal out of it. I mean, what do you think he feels Aubameyang is lacking? Or is it just the fact that Aubameyang is so good, he can play from the left, and we can get another goal scorer on the pitch in the centre-forward position?
It's kind of that, and I also think it's sort of moot. Like, Aubameyang is still... I mean, look at the goal he scored last night, for example. Like, he's still taking up great goal-scoring positions, and... You know, some of the top goal scorers in this league, Mane, Salah, etc., are playing from wide areas. If you look at the centre-forward role in Arteta's system, it involves a lot of shuttle runs on the halfway line.
Mm.
And if we play Aubameyang through the middle and he's asked to do that, people will say, oh, hang on a minute, this isn't what we wanted. I actually think playing for the left grants him greater opportunities in some respects, but I know not everyone sees it that way.
Mm.
I just think that he's got a specific role in mind for what he wants from his centre forward, and that Aubameyang, he feels, is better suited to the left side. But I don't doubt he could do it. I don't doubt he could do it, and I don't doubt that it's the best option for now. But it's an interesting question, isn't it? Like, if Lacazette isn't Arteta's ideal centre forward, sort of, is Nketiah? And if not, what is his ideal centre forward? I think that's something, well, something we might find out this summer.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, your question.
Okay, so let's have a look at this one. Right, well, Danny Sabas was very good last night. We had a lot of variations on this. Kajav Kapoor on Twitter said, what would be your ceiling to pay Madrid for Ceballos? And he says, if it's between 20 to 25 million, I'd take it. A midfielder of his age and ability elsewhere could easily cost 40 million plus.
Mm, I don't know. Genuinely, I don't know what the right price is for Ceballos.
Right.
Because I don't know what the market is going to be like yet. I don't think the market is going to be quite as different as we thought it was. Maybe it will when things open up properly. But some of the deals that we've seen going through or being agreed now don't really indicate that the arse is going to fall completely out of the transfer market. I mean, we had a question, I think, from Burner on the Discord. He says, do you think it's time to start giving real consideration at trying to keep Ceballos? I thought Arteta's comment afterwards was quite interesting. When he talked about Ceballos and he talked about the possibility of him staying. And what did he say? Fill the gap here, James, while I Google frantically.
Yes. Okay. Well, I remember making the case, actually, earlier this season, before the economy imploded, that there might be an argument. This was very early on in the season when Sabas was in a good run of form, that there was an argument for sort of buying him at his relatively high price of sort of 35 to 40 million, because at his age and with his quality and with his probable suitors back in Spain, you know, there was a decent chance that you would recoup that at some point. I think if you're able to get him for significantly less than that, I think it's a smart deal. I think it's a deal where you have a very good chance of turning a profit on a player, actually. If you could get him for 20 million, and who knows, because it's very difficult for us to pin down the exact parameters of what the transfer market is going to be like, I think you could probably flip him at some point for more money than that.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, the ideal, of course, would be that he continues to develop. He is still only 23 and be a good player for Arsenal. But what Arteta said in relation to a question about keeping Ceballos, he said, "I'm really happy with him. I think it's something the club has got to go a little bit further with Real Madrid on." So do you feel like he's kind of, you know, again, just applying a little bit of pressure to those upstairs? If his desire is to keep Ceballos, whether it's on loan for another season or to make the deal permanent, he's sort of suggesting to Raul and Edu, et cetera, that they need to do a bit more.
Just putting two and two together, I mean, I think quite a plausible deal here is that Arsenal take him on loan again, but with a healthy
option.
Loan fee,
yeah.
And an option. Yeah. So that they put a basic down payment on him and, you know, secure an option for what they might buy him for permanently down the line. And I don't think many people would question that. I mean, if you think of what we paid for Lucas Torreira, for example, about 30 million euros or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, you'd have to say that Ceballos, you know, should be in around that bracket, really. And I think if Arteta really likes him, I mean, basically my rule with players is if the current manager really wants them, let's get them. Because I think he's got good judgment.
Yeah, and I'll go back to what I said in the first half of the show, which is that, you know, Ceballos has really knuckled down. He's shown the kind of commitment that you know, you could start to depend on. I think what Arteta is looking for first and foremost are players that he can depend on, you know, that he can trust in. And Ceballos has gone some way to building that with Arteta. And we had another question on the Discord from Ansel, who says, could Guendouzi be used in a swap deal with Real Madrid for Ceballos? And I'm just thinking, why would Real Madrid want Guendouzi?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I think there is talent there, but whether or not Zidane would want to deal with someone like him, I really don't know. But, I mean, certainly he's a chip that you might try and use. And I think from Arsenal's perspective, I mean, Ceballos was playing in a way yesterday, doing things that I don't think Guendouzi can do.
Correct.
And that's... that's my assessment. You know, Guendouzi is a really promising player, but I don't think he's got that pass in his locker.
No, well, I mean, he's played 82 games for Arsenal. He's got a couple of assists. I mean, there was one very, very good pass for Aubameyang in the Spurs.
Yeah, Spurs game, yeah. And that's the one that really stands out to me. But
that's
I don't think...
the one.
Yeah, I don't think he produces it. And that's not revisionism on my part. Like, I've... You know, I'm not impressed by Guendouzi's conduct of late, but I've always felt that he's a good all-round player, but not someone who's necessarily a specialist in anything. And Sabas, some of those passes he produced yesterday, there was one cross-field, wasn't there, out to Tierney?
Yeah,
that was like, whoa, that was a confident player doing that. And it was quite exciting. So, yeah, I'm sort of coming around to the idea that we keep him, which I would not have believed, you know, maybe midway through this season. If we can find a way to do it that's financially viable and sensible, and Arteta likes him in there, then by all means. I still think there's, in the longer term, you know, we're talking about a partnership between Xhaka and Ceballos. I sort of kind of sense that in my ideal setup for this Arsenal team, there's probably a third central midfielder there. And maybe it's Saka. I don't know. But maybe it's Thomas Partey. But yeah, I like what I've seen from Sabas, and I like what I've seen from his character.
Okay, fair enough.
Let's have another question, shall we?
Just hang on one sec. I think there might be somebody at the door. Just bear with me one sec.
Okay.
Okay.
Any excuse for the music, I guess.
Sorry about that. I'm back. I am back. What were we doing? You were about to ask a question.
Yeah, this is from the Discord. It's from Duran. And they say, 7 games into the 5 substitutions rule. What are your thoughts on it so far? Would you agree with IFAB's decision to push it on for another season? I feel that we're definitely one of the teams who benefit from this change, especially with a crowd of youngsters fighting to get some game time.
I've quite liked it. But I haven't really noticed it, if that's the right word, from an opposition point of view. But I'm watching the games now wondering, what are we thinking in terms of how we're going to use these 5 substitutes? And how are we going to use them, and how might they impact the game? I know there are concerns, and probably legitimate concerns, about this being a rule that benefits the bigger teams, those with deeper squads and what have you. And I do understand that. But I like it. I quite like it. You know, the fact is, you're not making any more changes or stoppages in the game, I should say. It's still the same number of stoppages. So you have to be maybe a little bit more creative with your substitutions, because you've got to use a double or a triple sub, you know, in one of them. So
I think the drinks break is sort of more damaging to the flow of the game, I have to say.
I don't understand the drinks break in the Premier League. Playing football in Spain in July, where, you know, when they never play because it's summer, it's high summer there, and the temperatures get ridiculously hot, particularly if you're playing games in the daytime, I fully understand the need to have a drinks break and to let players rehydrate.
Yeah.
I do not understand why there's a drinks break 20 minutes into the first half of a game taking place in London, where it is pissing rain and it's 14 degrees and nobody's in any danger of ending up dehydrated. I think I'd have more issue with that than with the subs.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it was cold here the other day. It's like November or something.
Yeah, it's been absolutely shit here too.
So the drinks break, I think, is problematic, and I do think slows things down substantially. I would tend to agree. The 5 subs thing, I do see. I mean, Michael Cox has made a big case against it. He feels it really benefits the big teams.
Right.
I think it benefits us. So subjectively, biasedly, I quite like it.
Yeah, I mean, it gives us a chance to play some of the younger players as well, or give them some game time. So, I mean, I think there's an element of it benefiting a club from a developmental point of view as well. Some players are getting minutes that they might not ordinarily get.
So, yeah, and I have to say, sort of the selection of 7 substitutes, I think had sort of reached a point of kind of feeling a bit absurd, given the size that squads were generally bigger than that. It seemed very harsh that it was like, oh, Callum Chambers, you're not in the squad today. Do you know what I mean? I like that everyone's included in the match day experience. I think that probably does engender a bit of a better spirit among the players. You know, the sense that, like, well, I genuinely might be involved on Saturday. I might even play, even if I'm not the first 11 or even the first 15. So as an Arsenal fan, I'm quite happy to see it stay. But I don't think we know enough about it yet. I feel like managers are still sort of figuring it out.
Yeah. Okay, we'll see what happens. It is going to be continued into next season, apparently. Expected to be ratified in the next couple of days. And we'll see long term.
We did say we don't think it will go away. I think we said that when it was introduced.
Yeah.
I think it is one of the elements that will definitely stay.
Yeah, okay. Here's a question from Mitch, who's at the AFC Franco, who says, do you believe some of these players are looking good, for example, Ceballos, because of no pressure or no crowds? Ceballos is a perfect example, as he was struggling a little bit pre-lockdown. Also, Mustafi, who has now looked our best centre-back. Thinking face, thinking face, thinking face. Food for thought, or am I waffling?
Well, no, I mean, it's something we talked about before, and something that... does affect players. You know, certain players cope better than others with the pressure of live crowds and live performance. I mean, I'm not sure. I think there are enough other factors contributing to Ceballos' improvement that I'm not sure I put it down to that. Although we have talked about Arteta kind of coaching him in game to an extent, which you probably wouldn't have heard, to be honest, in a full Emirates Stadium. As for Mustafi... See, he's a case where I could imagine, for example, that he could benefit from there not being a crowd. Like, the intake of breath every time the ball goes near him probably isn't conducive to confident performances. The only thing I would say is, I think his improvement actually predates the lockdown.
Mm.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. Maybe. I think it's a soft factor. But what I do, or what did occur to me last night was... maybe halfway through that second half when Leicester were on top, you know, and maybe as a home side, what you're lacking is that moment or that sort of, you know, the way something can happen and the crowd can really get behind and they can sort of start to, I don't mean inspire the team, but it's sort of, it creates an energy within the stadium that the team respond to, you know? That there's a level of... You're watching the opposition, there's a level of frustration, and let's say... I'm thinking of the moment where Kieran Tierney went in and tried to make a tackle. He slid in. I think he got penalised. If the Emirates goes crazy there because Leicester get a free kick because one of our players has been committed, maybe that's something that transmits itself to the players and the performance, you know, it sort of changes the momentum a little bit. I know it's impossible to say, you know, with any authority or with data or anything like that, that it could have an impact. But you can feel how it might.
My opinion is it absolutely has an impact. I mean, I think the idea that a crowd doesn't influence a game, to me, that's absurd. And maybe it's because my other job is that I go out in front of crowds and I deal with crowds and I understand like how that chemistry can affect everything. And Lee Dixon said something interesting on Handbreak Off the other week where he said if he felt that his team were under the cosh, he would do something on the field to ignite the crowd. Like, he would get in an argument with somebody or square up to someone or have a go at the referee or, you know, win himself a free kick, because it could just give an injection of energy to a team, or impetus to a team. I think it absolutely makes a difference. And that's a really good point about the second half that I hadn't considered. And actually, to an extent, about the second half against Norwich, where they were, you know, significantly better in the first period of the second half, and it kind of took Arteta's water break talk for Arsenal to get back in control of the game. And, you know, I do think that maybe had the crowd been there sort of 55 minutes, 60 minutes in, I don't know, maybe it could have been different. So it's a really good point. In terms of the individuals, there's not an obvious example to me yet of someone who's massively thrived without there being a crowd there. But I don't doubt that it's a factor in some people's performances.
Mm. Okay.
Let's have a look for a question. In fact, it's your question, isn't it? No, it's mine.
It's yours, but I can bang one out if you want.
Bang one out, because I'm not prepared for this eventuality.
Okay, I know we're a bit tight for time today, so we're going to maybe just do a couple of quick ones. Would Xhaka left-back instead of Kolasinac work, says Joe, who's at Red and White 11 on Twitter. He's played there before. It would still allow him a lot of possession in deep left midfield and would allow a ball carrier into our midfield, i.e. Willock.
Yeah, I've seen that theory mooted. I mean, do I think he'd be significantly worse than Kolasinac there? No. And Kolasinac was all right last night. You know, I'm not saying that to be critical, but I think Xhaka could do that job. I'm not sure that it's in on the cards, simply because Arteta's kind of talked up Xhaka in midfield so much that I don't see him taking him out of there. I think that he's probably looking at Pablo Mari as someone who can play that position whenever he's eventually fit again as a left-sided centre-half. But Xhaka in an emergency, but I'm not in a hurry to take Xhaka out of the midfield. What about you?
I think if we had slightly more experienced options in midfield for that particular role, I might be more inclined to go with it. Ultimately, though, I think it would be very much a sticking plaster move. You know, I think Xhaka is very, very good on the ball, and I can see why and how he might bring qualities to that position. It was interesting, wasn't it, when Arteta first took over, he was sort of playing that kind of a role by dropping in there from midfield when we were playing with a back four. But as a starting system, I'm not sure that's something that I would go with. I feel like we need Xhaka in midfield. I think performances and results since he came back into midfield, having missed the first couple of games after the restart, have been much improved. And I think he's a fairly important part of that. Whether people like Xhaka or not, it's pretty difficult to argue against the improvement that we've seen in the results and the overall performances, which are, you know, again, it's we've got to point out, are not perfect. There's still a long way to go. There are things which we can improve and all that kind of stuff. But I just feel like we are a better side with Xhaka in midfield than without Xhaka in midfield. And I don't know that even if Xhaka gives you more passing range than Kolasinac, which, you know, isn't difficult, I think, on the ball. He's yeah, I'm not being funny or facetious. Yeah. I think he is extremely limited as a footballer. I think if you send him down the left-hand side, he's quite happy. You know, bomb down, get your head down, run down the left, put a cross in. There was one great run, actually, yesterday where he took the ball through from that position.
He got forward quite a lot.
He did. Yeah. He did very well. It was a great run. I think he played it outside to Tierney, who had a little bit of rush of blood to the head with his cross and overhit it. But it was a really nice play from Kolasinac. But I think that's where he's effective. If you're looking to build play from a back three, I just feel like he's a real weak link there. So while I see the logic in putting a player in there who can do more with the ball, I think we need that player who is Xhaka in midfield.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. What about this? I mean, I don't know, it's hypothetical, so you might hate it. We'll try. Yoel Romero says, with the news in L'Equipe of Juventus potentially being interested in Lacazette on a swap deal basis, who at Juve would you look to swap for? Aaron Ramsey.
That's what everyone's expecting. I would have to look at the Juventus squad and see. I mean, look, if we're looking for a midfield player, Rabiot is there. He's somebody who we've had a long...
Did he score?
Yeah. Holy shit.
That's some goal. I mean, wow. To carry the ball that far, he must have been so knackered at the end of it. And then to boot it into the top corner.
He's a bigger guy than I thought. Has he, like, had a bit
he's
of...
He's always been
has
tall,
he had some,
yeah,
like, growth jizz injected in him and stuff? You know what I mean?
It does seem that way. Yeah, I mean, he would be on the list, I guess.
I'm trying to think who else is... I mean, we don't need Wojciech back, even though my heart wants
Wojciech
him.
Wojciech Buffon. There are some players we're just not going to get as well.
Higuain, no.
I mean, yeah, Bentancur, the Uruguayan midfielder, I could see that as a possibility, given that we need players in the middle of the park. He's sort of 23. He's the right kind of age. Juventus has got a lot of very good players who are quite old, like Matuidi, Kadira, Ronaldo, Bonucci, you know. Chiellini.
Does Bentancur...
They've got a few guys in their 30s.
Oh, yeah. He is good, actually. They keep Lucas Torreira nice and happy as well. Little Uruguayan mate.
Little Uruguayan mate for him. Exactly.
Have their tea together and stuff.
It is an incredibly old squad, Juve, when you look at it. I mean, even someone like Cuadrado is 32. Higuain, 32. Ronaldo, 35. Kadira, 33. Matuidi, 33. They've got some younger players, but they've got a lot of experience.
Yeah, they're going to have to change the age profile of the squad, you would imagine.
Do they want Guendouzi as well, while they're at it?
Yeah, there's 21. Nice little addition to their squad. I mean, it does seem like all the interest, and this is a story in L'Equipe, wasn't it, that Juventus are interested, Atletico Madrid are interested, Inter Milan are interested. And we spoke on the last podcast, didn't we, about what Arteta had said about Lacazette when it comes to a new contract. It wasn't, yes, let's get him signed up to a new contract. It was more, let's have a chat with him and see what he, you know, how he feels and what he sees for himself in the last few years of his career, because he is 29 now. So, you know, he's not a player whose legs are getting any fresher, as we can see on the pitch. So he might fancy a change. So,
absolutely.
So I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to know exactly what Mikel Arteta wants. I'm willing to kind of go with what he thinks this summer, rather than have particularly strong opinions on what we need to do in the transfer market. I mean, I think we can all see that there are some gaps in the squad and places that need to be improved, but...
Well, let's hope it looks like his business. Let's put it like
that. That is key, yes. That is absolutely key.
And I think
key.
There are all certain telltale signs that will enable us to know.
Yeah. Yes, there might be. I'm trying to think what else we've got in terms of questions. There was one about Ozil, but I just can't do it.
Yeah, I saw that and I just thought, oh, man.
I mean,
he posted just on Twitter just now, by the way. I don't know if you saw his highlights from the 2019-20 season.
Right.
It's a short video. But I... yeah, I can't get into that.
I can't, no.
We can talk about Guendouzi. I'm happy to talk about Guendouzi because that's relatively novel, you know, compared to the Ozil thing.
Yeah, but I mean, what's new? What's new here about Guendouzi where, you know, he's had this meeting with Arteta and Edu and didn't impress?
The only thing that's new is that we know that he's not training with the group, really, and that he had the opportunity to express... you know, what the club were looking for him to express, and he didn't, and also hasn't. You know, the ball is very much in his court.
Yeah.
And he's not come back.
Yeah, like we said earlier, this is a player who, at a critical time of the season, is deliberately making himself unavailable to the manager. And I think that reflects far more on him than the discipline that Mikel Arteta and the club are trying to instill. And people can obviously make up their own minds whether they like Guendouzi or don't like Guendouzi. I think this kind of behaviour from a player is pretty much unacceptable, you know. It's not like he has to sort of get in his hands and knees and be supplicant and, you know, beg for mercy. There are things that are expected of him. He's not willing to do that. He's being petulant. He's being intransigent. And I think... you know, if we're going back to Ceballos and what we're talking about with Danny Ceballos and Mikel Arteta looking to build a squad of players that he can trust and believe in and have faith in, Guendouzi is basically behaving in a way which is the complete opposite of that. So
yeah, and we made this point in part one, but the responses to adversity of Ceballos and Guendouzi quite neatly contrast, don't they? And their standing with Mikel Arteta at this point contrasts too.
Mm. Look, we better leave it there because I know we are tight for time today. So thank you to everybody for listening. Sorry we don't have a win for you, but still an interesting game to look back on. There is, of course, the small matter of the North London Derby on Sunday. What a big game that is going to be. It really, really is. It feels like things are being amped up. I mean, Mourinho being pissed off about a Facebook post by Arsenal is as classic Mourinho as it can get, to be honest.
I know.
What do you think about it? Did you laugh at that, or were you?
Yeah, you love to see that sort of thing, don't you? I mean, it's great. It's great. I don't know what's going to happen on Sunday, but it's our first derby at this new stadium, isn't it?
It is.
So it'd be great to christen it with a win, and I want to see that Mourinho post-match interview. Please give it to me, Arsenal.
Yes, come on, Arsenal, do your thing. We will discuss that game on Monday on the Arsecast Extra, but before that, we will have a regular Arsecast for you on Friday, so make sure you join us for that. As ever, thanks for being here, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.